It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. 56 years ago today. Seems like a long time, doesn't it? 56 years ago today, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law. And ever since, the right wing, the Republicans have been losing their ever-loving freaking minds. Socialism, oh my God, the end of humanity as we know it. It would be the scourge of the country. In fact, the AMA, the American Medical Association back then, paid the sainted Ronald Reagan a handsome sum to record an album that they basically gave away to people to have little parties in their home and listen to the sainted Ronnie talk about how, it was the end of how did the thing go? We'll tell our grandchildren's grandchildren and they'll remember what it once was like to be free because socialism was coming. Reagan said, socialism, this is going to lead to socialism. Our children will be told what they will have to do for a living. And the thing is they scared the living bejesus out of people. And, you look back over the 56 years of Medicare and the lives that it has made better, the lives that it has saved, my grandmother, my grandfather, countless people that I've known that all of us know. Socialism. The scourge of socialism. Now, what's funny, it's one of those things that it's not only funny, but kind of sad. I've had conversations with people who have this idea of the sainted Ronald Reagan, who was dead set against Medicare because it was going to lead to the slippery slope to socialism. Yet Reagan himself expanded Medicaid several times over his presidency, signed legislation mandating coverage for children. Now, look, I don't beat him up for it because that's a good thing. Make sure kids are covered. They get the shots, the vaccines they need. Make sure they get the checkups because we know overwhelmingly you use healthcare in the first 5 years and the last 5 years of life. That's when you use the most healthcare. So ensuring that our children get the care that they need early, good on him for doing it. Good on for the Democratic-controlled House and Senate who put it on his desk and him signing it, but he did. Also, he expanded Medicaid to pregnant women who were receiving cash assistance. So he was given the welfare queens, who were driving around in the Cadillacs, drinking Dom Perignon, eating steak and all that. He gave them health insurance, which is why today we're in a position where over half of the children in this country who were born here are born with Medicaid. Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? The socialism. Over half of us were born thanks to Medicaid. He also mandated, and this is the one that, for all of my conservatives, all of my friends who think the sainted Ronald Reagan did no wrong, walked on water, floated, whatever, maybe is in an island somewhere. He mandated emergency treatment. Here it comes. You ready? You ready for this? Here it comes. He mandated emergency treatment for illegal immigrants, for undocumented people, for people who were here, they got hurt, they got seen by doctors. OMG. Like, I don't know. Yes, the sainted Reagan did that. He did a couple other expansions as well. And again, I'm not going to beat him up for it. Now, who I will beat up for it is Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, who today tweeted out on the anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid being signed into law. She said, today's anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid reminds us to reflect on the critical role these programs have played to protect the health care of millions of families. To safeguard our future, we must reject socialist health care schemes. Do I need to explain? Seriously, do I need to explain? Because you had Reagan who was saying this is going to lead us to socialism. Now Stefanik is saying we need to protect what Reagan feared would lead us down this horrid path out of fear of something leading us down this horrid path. This is almost as dumb as the guy from Lebanon just down the road from where I'm at telling Arlen Specter, get your government hands off my Medicare. I mean, it's that kind of level of stupid. And it's like gold medal stupid. I mean, it's the kind of stupid that you go, either you're really, really dumb. The guy in Lebanon, I put in that category. Olympic caliber stupid. Her, much smarter than this. This is playing to the guy in Lebanon. This is playing to the Olympic stupid. This is pandering. This is continuing the fear. Socialism's bad. Socialism's coming for you. Socialism's going to take your children. While protecting something that they believe is socialism. I mean, that's the weird part of this. And if you go back and you look at what Medicare and Medicaid have done, incredible programs that have helped millions of people. Because as I said, we ensure, we the people, the public, through socialism, the old and the young, the people who use the most healthcare, the people at the first 5 years and the last 5 years. It's what we do. We have taken them out of the healthcare system, and we've said as a country, through our government, that we're going to make sure that they get the insurance that they need so they can get the care that they need. That just because you're poor or you're old or you're young, you should be able to see a doctor. Now, the system that we have, which is a really kind of a hodgepodge, bizarre kind of system of we're going to take the most expensive people out of the equation, the old and the young, the people who are using healthcare. We're going to take them out of the insurance pool. And we, the taxpayer, through socialism, are going to cover them. So all of those Trump supporters who were, you know, walking up to vote for him on election day, pushing the oxygen tank, gasping on their last breath with their canes, you know, going, we're going to fight socialism. No problem with Medicare because it benefits them, even though socialism, we've taken them out of the equation. And what we've done is we've said, the people who can get up and go to work, you know, the healthier people. We're gonna have the private system pick their bones dry, and then we're gonna saddle them with massive premiums and co-pays and all kinds of stuff so that we can make profit off of them. And this is where one of those things where I go, why can't we just open up Medicare to everyone? Why can't I buy Medicare? Why can't we affix a price to it and say, you know what? Anybody who wants it, here it is. You know how many people would leave their jobs tomorrow and retire and do something that they want to do? You know how many people would put out their own shingle and start their own businesses? The entrepreneurial spirit of this country would be unleashed, which is partially why the right wing of this country is bought and paid for by corporate America, why it doesn't happen. So if I can say it, happy birthday, Medicare and Medicaid. A couple years older than I am. Good for you. I hope that the Republican Party doesn't kill you off anytime soon while singing your praises like Elise Stefanik has done. Now, remember, these are the people who wanted to kill the dreaded Obamacare because Medicaid was a huge part of that. But never mind. Never mind reality. The other big story of the day, you may have seen this already, but some handwritten notes by someone at the Department of Justice, basically laying out Trump's plan to overthrow our government. Evidently, he urged the Justice Department to say publicly that the election was corrupt, which would have given him the ability to do whatever, declare martial law, declare the election, you know, rigged, whatever, and then throw it to the House of Representatives, of which during when this was going on, we talked about how Republicans had the control of votes, even though Democrats held the House. The way it would be counted, one state, one vote, Republicans had the majority of votes. And it was going to be led by, the R congressman that the note points out. Evidently, Trump told this person, just say the election was corrupt, plus leave the rest to me and our congressmen. Our congressmen are gonna take care of it. They're going to take action. And one of the names that they threw out there was my congressman, Scott Perry. And Scott, if you're listening, and I know you do listen, pack a toothbrush, buddy. Because if this is true and you made some actions towards this coup attempt, good luck in prison. And as I was saying to someone earlier today, I go, you know, he could have been he could still be the Smedley Butler character who comes out and says, yeah, you know, the Republicans tried to overthrow our government again. But used a general, that is Scott Perry. Good looking guy, you know, articulate. I'm gonna judging from this, I'm gonna throw Crooked in there. It's gotta be there. Scott, so if now's the time to step forward, now's the time to speak up. If you and the Donald had some things worked out, now's the time. And this is why this investigation is so important. Because day after day, this kind of stuff is going to come out. Because we know that there were shenanigans going on. We know that they were looking for someone to say Arizona was fraudulent, Georgia was fraudulent. Because understand, flipping Arizona and Georgia wouldn't have mattered. Biden won by a sufficient number of votes and a sufficient number of electoral votes. It didn't matter. He won. And, you know, as this story goes, there were, you know, the acting attorney general, this Jeff Rosen, had these notes. And they're even talking about replacing him with someone who might be more sympathetic to get the outcome that they wanted. I mean, there's so many things here that are just patently un-American. Now, Rosen told him, evidently, according to the notes, we're doing our job. Much of the info that you're getting, Mr. President, is wrong. It's false. Because Trump was watching Fox News. He was watching the crazy channels. And they were all telling him, no, you know, it's all fraudulent. And I had the greatest back and forth recently with a Trump supporter who, you know, went on this whole thing that, you know, Donald Trump won. He won the election because the Dems cheated. And I said, well, how do you know? He goes, well, you know, David Barton, you know, this kooky claims to be a historian. He claims that there's one person who voted several thousand times in Georgia. One guy, real busy. I mean, I don't know how many precincts he could have drove to in one day. It's not going to be several thousand. But according to them, very soon you're going to see it. But beyond that, he said, because the polling says so, which is freaking weird. Basically saying there's no evidence, and we know there's no evidence. We can't find any evidence to say that any fraud happened or any cheating happened. But people believe it. This is their argument. People believe it, so it had to happen. And he cited a Rasmussen poll, which you go, really? One of the most biased polls out there. That's the one you're going to go for? And even only they came up with 55% of Republicans believe that. Well, they claim there were some Democrats, but it was mostly Republicans of going, yeah, 55% believe there was some fraud. And you go, look, I can skew a poll any way I want based on the sample size and where I take that poll. I go to a Trump rally, overwhelmingly, people are going to say, their election was rigged. They stole it from us, because they have to believe that. I mean, seriously, this guy. And I had to ask him. I go, you know, at some point, do you ever think you'll if you're wrong, do you ever think that you can admit you're wrong? And the reality is they're so vested in this stop the steal. They're so vested in that there was fraud and there's no way possible that the rest of the country couldn't have agreed with them. And they, you know, they saw Trump in this light of a hero god. And they can't believe that anyone else would look at him and see him in any different light. And this guy was visually angry at my assertion that he's a criminal. And we should be locking criminals up, and all of the people on January 6th who were quote unquote tourists and martyrs and all of that, they should be locked up for a good long time. Couldn't believe it. And it was this weird kind of thing that you just go, this alternative reality is very bizarre. Very, very bizarre. Some other good news. DOJ saying that Trump's tax returns can be released to Congress. So we may actually, I have said, and I'll be happy if I'm wrong, and I've said that as well. I have said I don't think we're ever going to see the tax returns. Now that the DOJ has said Congress can see them, maybe, I'm not jumping on the, we're going to see them. Maybe we'll get to see them. Maybe. So I think that's going to be something to watch out for. And also, one of my favorite stories yesterday, Mike Lindell, the former crack addict turned religious zealot. Have you ever noticed that people who had addiction problems, that they turn one addiction like crack or alcohol or whatever into another addiction like religion? Think Glenn Beck. Think Mike Lindell. Evidently, the crusader Lindell said he is going to stop advertising on Fox News because they will not. They're not going to play his crazy ad. Look, the guy's really lost his, he's lost it. And look, I take no joy in someone before our very eyes having a serious mental breakdown. This guy truly delusional. He is, again, but this is that demographic. This is that party. Old white guy, Republican Party, mental health break. So I think maybe we expand Medicare, hearing, vision, dental, and mental health. Something we can do. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1866. That was the day known as the Mechanics Institute Massacre. Black and white Republicans in New Orleans called a constitutional convention to consider voting rights for African Americans. It would be another 3.5 years before the ratification of the 15th Amendment. Freedmen, many of them Civil War veterans, gathered at the Faubourg Marnie and proceeded to march to the convention held at the Mechanics Institute on Canal Street. Just before they reached the institute, Black Republicans were confronted by a mob of white Democrats, ex-Confederate soldiers, and police determined to prevent blacks from attaining any semblance of civil or political rights. The delegates were able to momentarily beat back the mob and reach the Mechanics Institute. But the racist mob charged again and started shooting. By the time it was over, at least 50, mostly black Republicans, were shot dead in the street. More than 200 were seriously injured. Historian Justin Nystrom notes that it was an absolute massacre. But he adds, it was actually very useful to the Republican Party because it gave them a concrete example of the kinds of problems former Confederates were causing in the South. He adds that events such as these helped influence voters to bring more radical Republicans into Congress. These politicians would be key to passing the Reconstruction Acts. Nystrom points to a poem written by Camille Naudin to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the massacre. Titled Ode to the Martyrs, the poem mourns the massacred while bitterly observing that Jefferson Davis remained alive. But for the mulattoes, blacks, and whites, this fact I must tell, she writes. Victor LaCroix is dead. Jeff Davis lives still. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I keep hearing everybody complaining about the infrastructure plan. It's too costly, Rick. We can't possibly have everything that Joe Biden and the liberals want. Because, look, you even got Senator Dipsy Doo from Arizona coming out and saying the same thing. The guy from West Virginia, him too, on board, claiming, we just can't run the debt up. And look, as a working class liberal, I am a tax and spend guy. The first part being, we got to start taxing people. And the sad reality, as a working class liberal, I'm tired of being the one shouldering the burden. It's about time we start taxing the very well-to-do and these big corporations. Now, there's a new report coming out, or it's out now, from the good folks over at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, highlights just how easy corporate America has gotten off, a lot thanks to the last guy's tax scheme. But when you find out that 39 Fortune 500 companies paid zip, nothing in federal income tax, yet we're wildly profitable, I got a problem with that. Another 73, they find out, paid half, less than half of the already lowered 21%. I go, we got a problem. Houston, there is a problem. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad this is and, well, how we fix it, I've asked Amy Hanauer to come talk with us. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP, their website, ITEP.org. Amy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So am I getting these numbers right? I'm getting the 39 companies made, buku bucks in profit, paid absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's right. And not only, you're underestimating by one thing. We're talking about over 3 years. So we'd previously found that 55 profitable Fortune 500 corporations paid nothing in taxes on their 2020 income. And then people came back and said, oh, you can't go by 1 year. They might have overpaid the previous year, blah, blah, blah. So we were like, okay, great. We're going to go and look at the last 3 years, all of the years since the Trump tax cuts took place. And we found that 39 paid zero taxes over that whole time period combined. And this is over a time period when those corporations combined had $122 billion in profits. So it's really, really outrageous. These are corporations that are benefiting from the things we spend money on, and they're just not contributing.
Yeah, and the thing is, I say all the time, because I have my very pro-business conservative Republican listeners who say, well, Rick, we can't tax these corporations. We need them. I'm sure you've heard that song and dance. And I said, we need to go back to a good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code. Because back then, corporate America was paying 56% tax. And guess what? They were still profitable.
Right. That's right. I mean, that's the thing, is that under time periods when corporate taxation has been much, much higher than it is today, we've been able to grow the middle class. We've been able to have better jobs. We've been able to really invest in our economy. And I think we've really kind of gotten away from that. And you kind of brought up another part of this, which is the zero corporations are a problem. But here's the thing, a lot of those that pay something still don't pay anything like what we expect them to pay and what they owe. So Trump lowered the corporate tax rate to 21%. And there was some sort of claim that there would be some loophole closing or people would actually pay the 21% once we lowered it. Well, we found that 73 big corporations paid less than half the rate over that period. So on top of the 39 that paid nothing, you had another 73 that over a 3 year period paid, 3%, 5%, 7%, whatever.
But the good thing here is, and there's a positive, there's a silver lining. We got to watch Jeff Bezos take the oldest person and the youngest person into space. So our money well spent, because Amazon, as you pointed out, during those 3 tax years, paid an effective rate of 4.3%. That's less than the person who's working at McDonald's is paying in tax rates.
That's right. I mean, that's the funny thing, is that with some of these corporations, if you paid 1 month of your phone bill for T-Mobile, you paid more taxes than they paid over 3 years, right? So it's pretty outrageous. And no, I mean, you know, that's I think the exact point is that the CEOs of these corporations, the stockholders in these corporations are raking it in. And, you know, it's fine. They should do fine. We have no problem with that. But Jeff Bezos could still go to space and he could pay his fair share of taxes so that, you know, we could get vaccines to Amazon employees. We could get, you know, we could enforce labor law when it's being ignored. And, you know, we could help it so that working class kids can go to college. In some cases, the kids of some of these very employees.
Yeah, we could do all of those great things, healthcare for people, education for people, all that stuff. But even in Bezos's radical self-interest, you say better roads to get your products to people's houses quicker, you know, better airports, better air traffic so that you get your stuff moved around. I mean, we pay for all of this stuff and these folks benefit from it. Yet they, again, seem to be walking away from actually paying for what they're benefiting from. That's what's infuriating to me, Amy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the biggest point is like, who benefits most from the system we have? It's the people who are walking away with record profits. We've got inequality that's higher than it's ever been before. You know, we've got really, really wealthy people and they are totally, you know, they need the public sector to educate their employees. They need the public sector to deliver healthcare to their employees. They need the public sector to do vaccine research so that we can all get immunized against this dangerous disease. And yet they don't want to contribute to that.
But the good thing, and this is where I gave Jeff Bezos credit, and I don't often give him credit, but he did on the day he came back from space for his 10-minute little jaunt. He did come out and say, look, yeah, thank you to my employees. Thank you to my customers. You guys paid for all this. Thanks. You know, obviously you with lower wages and less healthcare and less, you know, less all of that stuff. And you, the consumers who are, you know, basically cheating local tax bases out of the taxes. Hey, thank you for everything you've given me so I can have my big $500 million bathtub boat and go play in space. Every child's dream. Thank you for paying for that.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And you know, it's not, I mean, I love picking on Bezos as much as the next guy, but it's not just Amazon, right? Nope. I mean, you know, they're one of the worst offenders because they're so enormous and because they've historically treated their employees so poorly. But like FedEx, right? I mean, there's a non-union delivery company and they you know, they didn't pay any taxes over 3 years, right? Yep. If you shipped one thing through FedEx, you paid more to that corporation than they paid in taxes.
Yeah, and they're also one of those companies that abuse the independent contractor ruling. They're horrible. And here's the thing that gets me, and this is where, you know, I want to pick up on what you said about Bezos. I don't blame any of the CEOs. I don't even blame these companies. I'm not mad at them. They're simply playing by the rules of the game that they were able to lobby and get, and we allowed to have happen. This is our fault. We voted for politicians who allowed this to happen because this is what we've been sold. And this was supposed to be good for us. I don't think it's working as it was originally advertised.
No, I think that's exactly right. And here's the thing. Most people want fair taxes. Most people want corporations to pay their fair share. I mean, those things come out sky high on any kind of polling. But you're right, you know, the members of Congress are just susceptible to the lobbying by these really wealthy corporations and they let them write the rules. And so yeah, if you're gonna blame anyone, blame Congress, and then we gotta fix it. And the thing is, we can fix it, right? There's a lot that we could do to set this right and to make it so that we have more of what we need to, you know, to put in place schools, to pay firefighters, to, you know, to just pay for the things that this country needs.
No, you're right. But here's the thing. And I have listeners who say, well, you know, we need to do what Ronald Reagan did, what the sainted Ronnie Reagan did back in 86. We need to close all the loopholes. And I think we did for about 6 minutes, close the loopholes. And then the lobbyists came back in and were able to get them back again. I want these corporations to pay their taxes like everyone else, because the reality is if they're getting the advantage of not paying taxes, a company who they're competing with is paying their taxes. That's unfair to that company. And I don't want to see that. So how do we make the game balanced? How do we level this out to where corporate America is paying their fair share of taxes, nobody gets the advantage, and we get the resources that we need to pave our roads and bridges and do all the things that we've been talking about that we need to do? Because I don't think most people know how these companies get to evade paying taxes the way they do and the big loopholes out there, which is why, I'll be honest, the reason I wanted to see Donald Trump's tax returns. I wanted to see how rich people get away with not paying taxes.
Yeah, that's right. And so here's the thing. I mean, you know, a lot of it is sort of fancy words, right? So accelerated depreciation, a lot of manufacturing corporations kind of write off the entire cost of a piece of equipment that lasts for 30 years. They write it off in 10 years and then they get to take a much bigger tax break along the way. That's something we could get rid of. Stock options, you know, they pay their executive stock options, but they write off those expenses for tax purposes, and it goes far beyond the expenses that they actually report to investors. This is a crazy way of doing it. And then shifting their profits offshores, which not only reduces their tax bill, but it's bad for American workers, right? And it's bad for American communities because they ship their profits offshores and then they pay a lower rate.
Now, as I understand, isn't this something that the last guy's tax bill in 2018 really accelerated, gave them the ability to shift more of the profits offshore by using that, what is it, the territorial tax system that they were talking about?
That's right. And it was supposed to solve it. But like we all saw that, you know, the lobbyists just descended and got incredible deals for all of their corporations. So here's what I think is encouraging is that the Biden administration actually has a whole bunch of proposals that would do something about this. Right. And so it's not, you know, sometimes we kind of act like, oh, there's just nothing we can do. You know, this is just the way capitalism works. Well, that's not the case, right? Like we can actually fix this. And I think that's what we've got to hold our politicians accountable to doing.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's the thing. The second that Joe Biden came out and said, you know, we're going to raise taxes on people making over $400,000. We're going to put a lot of these other tax situations into place. One of the political parties in this country lost their ever-loving freaking minds because they all took the pledge that under no circumstances will they ever raise taxes. And that's been a non-starter with them, well, at least for the last 30 years, but most certainly when Biden proposed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy because they're willing to explode the deficit to spend on tax cuts. And then they, you know, they don't want any money to be spent on the things that working class communities need. And they act as if they're, you know, as if there's a sort of concern for working families. But the real people pulling the strings are the corporate interests.
And now we hear that we can't take on any more debt, Amy. We just can't. You know, our debt's way too high. I argue it's not too high yet. Right now is the time to be borrowing because we do need massive investments. We've gone decades without doing major upgrades to our infrastructure and also to our human infrastructure. Our social safety net has just been eviscerated over the last 40 years. We do need to rebuild that. But there is some argument that we may be taking on some too much debt. This is one of those moments where I think the public is on board with raising taxes. As I've said, I'm a tax and spend liberal. I believe you tax things, you spend on what you need. You don't waste the money. You spend it on stuff you need, but you got to pay for it. This is where I believe in being fiscally responsible. I think now is kind of the time for this, especially as you've pointed out over the last 3 years, just how well these companies have done and how well the wealthy has done since the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really incredibly appreciated by the public if we saw some real reform. And the truth is, you know, nobody wants to hit someone while they're down, but we're talking about profitable corporations, places that turn to profit all through the run up to the pandemic, and then they turn to profit during the pandemic and during the recession. So we're not talking about going after someone who was like a tourist related business that really took it on the chin last year. We're talking about highly profitable Fortune 500 companies, the biggest and wealthiest corporations that we have in this country. And they're the ones that I think ought to be paying.
I'm still trying to figure out how Domino's got out of paying taxes. I mean, I'm looking at some of the names going, you know, what incentives? Because, look, I'm a believer in you need to have, you know, loopholes to incentivize certain things. We want cleaner energy. We want policies that are going to move us in a different direction. But at some point, you know, how is pizza something that we're giving tax breaks for?
Yeah, pizza and beer, Coors Beer and Domino's Pizza were two of the ones on the list for having paid, you know, well under half the rate that you would have expected them to pay over a 3-year period. Etsy, you know, where, you know, we all might want to order something, certainly Amazon. And yeah, I mean, my colleague who does a lot of this research, and a lot of this research was done by Steve Womhoff and Matt Gardner in my office. They do great work, but they like to joke, like Netflix, for example, takes tax breaks for research. Like, what research are they doing? Like, how to get you to hit, you know, next movie, please, reload. And, you know, so like, what is it that Domino's is doing that makes them deserving of a tax break that, let's face it, like your local pizzeria can't get?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I have a problem with what we have allowed to have happen. And so where I want to end this is because we did this. We created this environment by the people that we voted for. We can undo this. You know, what are the specific policies we should be pushing for? What direction do you think we should be going towards with our tax code? Because I believe we need comprehensive overall of our tax system. Where do you think we should be going first?
Yeah. And, I at this point, given where we're at, I want to start with the items that are in the Build Back Better plan that President Biden has put forth, because it might not be exactly what we would have crafted, but it's like, this is viable. It's on the table. They worked through some of the biggest opposition to get to something that would kind of work. And so one of the things that he proposes is raising the corporate rates. That makes sense. You know, Trump lowered it to 21. Biden wants to only raise it halfway back to 28. It was, you know, it's previously been at 35. So yeah, we ought to do that. But then he wants to close some of the loopholes, because the rate is kind of meaningless if people don't pay it, if corporations don't pay it.
Correct.
And so one of the loopholes he'd close is that overseas profit shifting. So any offshore profits would be subject to a combined worldwide rate of 21%. That would get rid of a lot of this. And then the other is to just have like straight minimum tax on the profits that they report to their shareholders. And that would go a long way. So those are some of the things that are in Biden's plan. I think they make a lot of sense. I think they're viable. Look, we've been wrestling with this bipartisan plan. Great, go for it. Now it's time to get down to brass tacks and put something in place that actually imposes taxes on those who need to pay, so that we can, you know, get people putting up wind turbines, get people installing solar panels, and get this country moving again.
I'm right there with you, Amy. I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much for the work that you guys do over there at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. If you want to check out their website, itep.org, itep.org. We'll get links out on social media. Amy, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Great talking to you, Rick. Take care.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Should we do as I've proposed numerous times? Let's go back to the socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Top marginal tax rate on the wealthy, 92%, 56% on corporate America. You'd see them begging for the days of 35%. But you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day that U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed Medicare into law. This federally funded health care program provides assistance to one of the country's most vulnerable populations, the elderly. At the time the law was enacted, many seniors found it difficult, if not impossible, to get private health insurance. President Johnson signed the law in a ceremony in Independence, Missouri, the hometown of former President Harry Truman. While in office in the 1940s, Truman had proposed a national health insurance plan. Unfortunately, he was unable to get his plan through Congress. President Johnson wanted to recognize Truman's efforts. At the bill signing ceremony, President Truman received the very first symbolic Medicare card. The law went into full effect in 1966. 19 million people registered for the benefit. One of the labor leaders who fought for Medicare was Nelson Hale Cruikshank. Nelson held several positions for the AFL-CIO, and he spent his career advocating for social insurance protections for working people. He earned the nickname the Father of Medicare. The same year that the Medicare law was passed, Cruikshank explained why he thought it was so important to reform health insurance. He said, quote, "In too many doctors' offices today, the Hippocratic Oath has given way to the Dow Jones average. By 2010, 48 million Americans received their health insurance through the Medicare program. 8 million were people with disabilities. The rest were seniors. The program has had a tremendous impact on the quality of life of millions of older Americans. Yet, since its inception, there have been those who aim to make it less accessible by scaling back benefits and raising the eligibility age."
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, and I didn't get to talk about it yesterday. Yesterday was National Intern Day, or as I like to call it, National Free Labor Day for corporate America. Because look, a lot of these internships are not paid. The paid ones, I don't have a problem with. As long as you're paying minimum wage, that's the law of the land. I think the minimum wage is way too low. We should be bumping that up. But hey, if you're following the laws, I'm okay with it. But it's these free internships where they promise you, hey, if you come work for us, maybe there's something. Got a problem with that. Also, came out yesterday that the Biden administration is moving back against the joint employer ruling during the Trump years, which means that the big overarching company is responsible in wage theft cases. So think of all those fast food joints out there where we hear these horror stories of people being cheated out of wages, and the overarching company go, hey, not our problem, it's franchise. Now they're going to push back and hold people accountable. I think that is a good thing. But ultimately, in my view on it, if we had more unions in workplaces, we had more people organized, we had more people on the job with empowered to say no more, I think it'd be a much better place. So the question then becomes, how do we get more people joining and forming unions? Because we've seen the studies are out there. Overwhelmingly, people want to join. Why is it so hard? And here to share some thoughts on why it's so hard and what maybe we can do about it, I've asked Kelly Candale to come talk with us. Kelly's a journalist, filmmaker, former union organizer. His website, kellycandale.com. He's written a piece on why union votes are so tough for labor to win. Kelly, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, you're welcome. Good to be here.
So I guess we start there. We start, you know, how did it get so hard, and why is it so difficult when overwhelmingly we see the numbers out there where this is what people want?
Well, I mean, not to get too far into the weeds, but you have to go back into labor history, into the history of labor law in this country. And then that takes you to the overwhelming power of corporations and businesses in general to threaten people and to scare people. I mean, I used to listen to Michael Harrington back in the day when he was talking, and, you know, he'd give these speeches and he'd point out to people that you know, you look at Europe and it had kind of a bloody class struggle there in order for workers to get rights. And he said, but it didn't match what happened in the United States in terms of corporate and business opposition to workers having the fundamental right to organize. It was bloody. It was deadly. Workers saw every day what happened to their fellow workers when they tried to organize in many cases, and many of them were killed. And that, you know, transferred through our whole history. I mean, we got some relief in the 1930s with the Wagner Act and so on, but Taft-Hartley diminished a lot of that. And you see so many times corporate America doing whatever they can to stop workers from organizing. You'd think it was the death knell of a business or corporation to have a union in this country, particularly in the private sector. So it's just a terrible situation.
No, and we saw at Amazon, and, you know, one of the other pieces that you'd written is, you know, about, you know, can we have democracy in a place where Amazon is so powerful? And I argue no. I mean, the reality is, if you watch what happened in Bessemer, Alabama, they spent $200 million on a campaign to keep, you know, a couple of thousand workers from being able to say, hey, we'd like to have some say. We'd like to take a bathroom break every once in a while. We'd like a day off. Things that I thought we had already fought and won in past generations. But all that looks like it's up on the table now.
Yeah. I mean, especially in the private sector, as we've pointed out, in the public sector, you know, I was an organizer for 10, 15 years, mostly in the public sector, and it was easier to win elections in the public sector, still is, primarily because you don't have an opposition. I organized the air traffic controllers years ago after PATCO, and we won that election overwhelmingly. And the reason was we didn't have the federal government in this case saying, we're going to move air traffic controllers to Mexico. We're going to shut down your facility. We're going to have these captured audience meetings that are mandatory to come to. They couldn't fire air traffic controllers just because they were in favor of a union. So it was a different situation. I mean, nowadays, and we see this all over the place, when Walmart was organized in Canada, what did Walmart do? They shut down the facility. When the meat packers said they wanted to organize in a Walmart facility in Texas, what did Walmart do? They shut down the meat department, and they did it all throughout Texas. So these are not idle threats. So when organizers say workers are scared, they're telling the truth, because workers see what happens when they stand up to these powerful corporations.
And ultimately, it comes back to, we need to have legislation and any more militant workforce. I think they have to go hand in hand. And I guess I was fortunate enough to know a bunch of the organizers, you know, who had organized in the 50s and 60s and fought those bloody battles. You know, a couple of guys I knew got their skulls cracked open because, you know, cops hit them on the head with those sticks. They carry those sticks for a reason. And, yeah. You know, the stories that they told of, yeah, the Wagner Act helped. But it was the workforce. It was the militancy of the community and the people that they organized.
Yeah, you know, militancy, it's an interesting word, because in some cases it translates as strength. You know, it translates as resilience. You know, I can't let this interview go by without mentioning the death of Bob Moses, the great SNCC organizer who right. died last Sunday. One of the things that he said when he was in Mississippi, in the most difficult situation, where people were killed and beaten and thrown in jail, lost their lives over this freedom struggle. He said, when he was organizing, the people that he was talking to were always testing his courage. They were always testing his resilience, testing his character, because the big question that they wanted to know was, what was going to happen when an argument turned into a fight? And the answer was that Bob Moses and those other SNCC workers were going to stay around. And I think there's a lesson there for the labor movement and this loss in Bessemer. You know, what's going to happen? Are you guys going to stick around? Are you going to stick to it? Are you going to stay with us? And that's the lesson that I hope the Teamsters have learned, who have announced that they're going to try to organize Amazon now.
No, I'm right there with you. And in fact, some of the organizing that I've done throughout the years, it was the same thing. They wanted to see, when times got tough, which side of the equation you were on, if you'd stand there and fight, or if you just offer to hold their coat. And I'm hoping, yeah, like you said, I was thrilled to see my union come out and say that they're going to organize the Amazon workers. I was thrilled to see that. But ultimately, and look, they don't have a choice. They've got to organize Amazon, especially the delivery drivers, because if they don't, what Amazon is putting together could put a company like UPS and FedEx out of business.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that the main organizer for the Teamsters is a Southern California person out here where I live, and you know, he was pointing out that UPS drivers make about $38 an hour, additional 30 in pension and health. Amazon drivers, and they don't even know who they work for. I mean, in many of these cases, yep, make 16 at the warehouses where Amazon products are held. You know, the warehouses are owned by logistics companies. The workers, they don't know who they work for. There's 250 temporary employment agencies out in the San Bernardino and Riverside County, not far from where I live here. So the workers are in this ambiguous place in terms of who they actually work for. And that's a function of labor law, which is obviously also a part of this equation.
And this comes back to what I started off at the beginning, the joint employer rule. That the Obama folks wanted to tighten up and hold someone like Amazon accountable when they do just what you've said. Everything's a third-party logistics company, everything independent contractors, where they spread this out where it never, any violations, any cheating, any wage theft never gets back to them. And that has to stop.
Yeah. And I think that the approach, again, you know, a shout out to the Teamsters, that, you know, of combining this what you call militancy, organizational militancy, and using the resilience and dignity of the workers, starting with where they are and using their own energy, providing the resources and protection, of course, but also the politics of it. Can you leverage the politics through the Senate and Congress and pressure on people like Amazon, people on pressure like Bezos, people like pressure on Facebook to have a kind of a pincer movement that applies political pressure as well as organizational pressure in a way that might be successful? It's a very, very difficult task, obviously, because the deck is stacked against unions in this country and everybody knows it. But, you know, maybe with some political support, organizational support of the union the size of the Teamsters, there are some possibilities there.
But ultimately, it can't just be the Teamsters. It's got to be the entire movement, because after all, I do believe if you allow Amazon to go unchecked, their tentacles will get into every industry. I mean, the other day, my wife and I went to Best Buy to buy a camera, one of those, you know, web camera things. And we find out that it's an Amazon company. I went to Best Buy to buy something. I went to Best Buy to not buy something from Amazon, and there it was.
Yeah. You know, that kind of monopoly stuff is all over the place. I mean, just, you know, you look at any of the literature nowadays on how who owns what. You think you're getting a different rental car when you're going to Avis instead of Hertz or Avis instead of Budget, but they're all owned by the same company. And they just have different marketing strategies. So, yeah, I mean, but you're correct about that. It has to be the whole labor movement, and not only that, but the community as well. I mean, these union drives are not going to be successful without a great deal of community support. And I hope that's what the labor movement, and I think that's what the labor movement is heading towards in this big fight with these behemoths.
Well, they're going to have to. I mean, and the only way that they're going to be able to compete and to ultimately win is if we do get some comprehensive labor law reform, which is why I'm a big supporter of the PRO Act. Personally, I'd love to just go back and undo Taft-Hartley and return to the original intent of the NLRA, but that ain't going to happen. I'm hoping we get something through this legislative process, either through the budget reconciliation, even if it's just increased fines on people like Amazon who cheat. We got to get something.
Yeah. In fact, the Senate held a hearing last week in the Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee. You might want to reach out to Gracie Heldman, who was a worker that testified there, because she tried to join the Bakers Union in her company that she worked for. She's tried three times, 20-year struggle. Got 65% of the card signed. So a great deal of support in every one of those elections. And of course, the company hired a union busting firm and did months and months and months of delays and terror tactics and scare meetings and threats to close down and eventually lost those elections. So, you know, that's a kind of real on the ground story that is taking place in thousands and thousands of workplaces throughout the country. And we need to hear more of it rather than, you know, Jeff Bezos, you know, getting, you know, unbelievable media coverage for his little rocket ride into space. And then maybe he'll fly to the moon and stay there.
But. Right. And then his PR stunt of giving out money to a couple of different people. Oh, look how wonderful I am. If you were that wonderful, you'd given it to your employees. But to your point about the worker trying to organize, I had organized a place years ago where the owner came out and said, I'll close the doors before I allow there to be a union in here. And it wasn't even about money. It was strictly about control. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And I said, if we had any functional labor laws, the National Labor Relations Board would have taken that and imposed a contract and go, okay, fine. If you don't want to be in business, you're out of business. That's where I think things have to go.
Yeah, there has to be something. You know, I'm hoping that some sort of reconciliation process happens as well. I mean, clearly Biden, in all of his messaging and what he did when the Amazon election was happening in Alabama, coming out ahead of the election and saying that workers should vote for a union. I mean, those are all great signs. You know, the pressure has to be kept on him and others in the House and Senate, you know, to make that a reality. I mean, you've got, you know, Christian Sinema over in Arizona, and who's you know, not in favor of ending the filibuster, which would be the way to get this done with Senate votes and not have to dick around with this reconciliation process. And I was in Arizona and saw the labor movement, especially HERE Local 11 out there, you know, busting their butts to get her elected, and Mark Kelly, and all the community organizations that were going door to door during, you know, and this was during a pandemic, you know, standing a distance back. But, you know, those were the folks that got her and Mark Kelly elected. And so what the political strategy there is, I'm not quite sure. Some people are calling on maybe primarying her, and she's not up for a couple of years. But, you know, there's just dynamics out there that are good to see, you know, people active, you know, people engaged. And that's what we need to keep doing.
No, it's absolutely what we need to do. We need to have people voting their jobs first and stop allowing ourselves to be divided by these nonsensical social issues that for the majority of us don't even touch us, which is the bizarre part of it. But, yeah. You know, it's kind of where we are, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I just read a study, Thomas Piketty, that, you know, the French academic, looked at these political cleavages in 21 Western democracies in the last 60, 70 years. And, you know, they do conclude that these social cultural issues are what has divided particularly working class people from what used to be the natural base of the Democratic Party and now have drifted towards, you know, people like Trump and the conservatives. Yep. In many cases. So, yeah, voting your pocketbook, voting your union. Let's try to get that.
Yeah, right, you know, there with on. You. But as Jay Gould said, he can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. And that's what they've been using to do it. If you want to check out more of the articles that Kelly has, why union votes are so tough for labor to win, we'll get links out on social media. You can also check him out over on Capital in Maine. Kelly, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good talking with you.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
Good stuff, Kelly Candale. Make sure you check out his website, kellycandale.com. We'll get links out on that as well. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day that began one of the greatest mysteries of the United States labor movement. Teamster President Jimmy Hoffa disappeared in Detroit. Hoffa was the son of a coal miner. After his father died, Jimmy left school and went to Detroit to work in a warehouse. When Hoffa was only 20 years old, he organized a strike of dock workers at the Kroger Grocery and Bakery Company. He became recognized for his labor organizing skills and went on to head the Teamsters Union. Under Hoffa's leadership, the Teamsters had become the largest international labor union. He played a key role in negotiating the first ever National Freight Hauling Agreement. In 1967, he faced several charges related to a federal investigation. He was convicted of jury tampering and sentenced to 10 years in prison. President Richard Nixon commuted Hoffa's sentence in 1971, but the release was conditional upon his not participating in union activities for 10 years. Hoffa planned to appeal this restriction in court. What happened next is a mystery. He was reportedly scheduled to have a dinner meeting with Anthony Tony Jack Giacalone, a Detroit mobster, and Teamster boss Anthony Provenzano. When Hoffa did not return home that evening, his wife reported him missing. Both men denied they were supposed to have met with him. Hoffa's body has never been found. and the actual cause of his death has never been determined. In 1982, he was declared presumed dead. In 1992, Jack Nicholson starred in a biopic about Hoffa's life. His disappearance has generated considerable interest over the years with multiple theories, and still, the mystery remains unsolved. One thing that's not a mystery was his determination to make workers' lives better.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.